call the meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee to order.
We have a quorum. Representative Lunan moves approval of the minutes for March 8th. Any additions, corrections, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, today, excuse me, we're going to be hearing a presentation from Minnesota Department of Human Services, presented by Ms. Marie Zimmerman, Medicaid Director for DHS. So welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself to the committee and for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony and your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marie Zimmerman. I'm the State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'll have my colleague here introduce herself as well. We're going to be doing a presentation today and tomorrow as well on managed care procurement. So I brought somebody with me so you won't get too sick of hearing my voice between today and tomorrow. So, Heather, you want to introduce yourself?
Good afternoon. My name is Heather Peterman. I'm a Division Director in the Healthcare Administration at DHS.
Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing us the opportunity to walk through the Integrated Health Partnership Program today. I promise I will try not to use too many acronyms. Please interrupt. I'm sure that you will ask questions if I end up using too many of those. Although that one, I will just use IHP if folks are okay with that to describe our program. So an overview of what we're going to discuss today. We thought it would be helpful if we discussed very briefly sort of the national, where Minnesota sits sort of in the national landscape of payment reform and what other states are doing, but also what other payers are doing in terms of paying providers differently for health care. Then we'll walk a little bit into sort of payment reform beginnings in the state of Minnesota. This is something we've been working on for more than a decade in this state. And then we'll go to sort of where the Minnesota Integrated Health Partnership Program, IHP, is today. We'll sort of walk into the basics of the model. Then sort of the next phase that we just are starting to implement this year, which is IHP 2.0. I know it's a really unique name that we have there. And then sort of where we see IHPs moving forward, if that is okay with the committee members. So really, ACOs, accountable care organizations, see there I go right again with my acronyms right away. Maybe just really briefly on the term sort of accountable care organization. It's not necessarily meant to be one specific thing, but more of a concept. It is a way to pay providers based on outcomes. So quality outcomes for patients, the patient experience, but also reducing costs and holding providers accountable for total cost of care. This is part of a large multi-payer effort nationally. You can see that this is happening both with commercial payers. Medicare has several programs, and we have a slide where we'll touch on that briefly as well. And many Medicaid programs across the nation are also working on these types of efforts. And really what that's about is providers and payers trying to align to drive system transformation, delivering care in a different way, again, to improve outcomes but also experience. So this is just the direction that healthcare has been going for quite a number of years. So this is just highlighting some of the key features of some of those changes nationally. Again, sort of greater alignment of financial incentives towards outcomes, really that providers are best positioned to directly impact their unique patient populations and meet their individual needs. And we also see providers taking on a greater amount of risk. And that's both happening in, again, commercial products, Medicare, and Medicaid as well. This is just some examples. Actually, these are, I think, the prime examples of Medicare's payment reform and accountable care organization models. I'm not going to go into them, and I'm not going to pretend that I know all the details of them. We have tried very hard to align because that's been a lot of feedback that we've received from the providers in Minnesota is they want us to closely align with what Medicare is doing so they can have aligned incentives across their entire patient population. And we've had many Minnesota providers that have been participating in some of these since the very beginning. So, for example, I think three or four of our original IHPs were either in the Pioneer ACO program for Medicare or the Medicare Shared Savings Program. So this map, it is not our map, we borrowed it from somebody else, is really sort of describing multiple states that are trying to implement Medicaid ACO programs. Minnesota was actually the first state to be approved for a provider risk-based arrangement and an ACO program, and many states since that time have received approval or have pending approval as well. And I think one thing that this map highlights is that it's really a diverse set of states that are looking at doing this type of payment reform and programming. These states look very different than Minnesota's Medicaid program. And so, again, it's really sort of a national trend in trying to improve the experience of enrollees, but also figure out a way to make the Medicaid program more financially sustainable. One thing that I would note that is all the states that are gray does not mean they're not doing some sort of payment reform or value-based care. They're just not calling them sort of standalone ACO programs. So a lot of those other states are also working on similar type of financial arrangements for their providers. These are sort of the levels of payment reform as defined by and done through a series of a lot of different meetings and works with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. And really these are meant to be sort of the different levels of payment reform from a multi-payer perspective. So a lot of different payers had input into how to define these levels. So this is how essentially CMS is defining levels of payment reform. And you'll see that it sort of increases, sort of demonstrates increasing movement towards paying for quality as sort of one of the first steps tying payment to quality, having some focus on population health and also care coordination, sort of more care management functions at the provider level, and just a general movement away from fee-for-service and providers, again, taking on risk for total cost of care. And you'll see as we sort of walk through the beginnings of payment reform in Minnesota how we sort of followed a similar path and kind of had similar roots as this current definition CMS has. So kind of as usual, we're ahead of the game, or we've been ahead of the national trend for quite some time. So now I will move into kind of the beginning of some of the larger policy discussions that occurred more than a decade ago in the state of Minnesota. Really sort of the beginning of delivery system and payment reform. And the culmination of this work was really captured in the 2007 Governor's Transformation Task Force. And it was really the first recommendation, and you can see the excerpt of it there, for provider-based accountability for total cost of care and sort of paying for value, paying for outcomes. And so these were the levels. You can see they kind of match where CMS today. That task force in 2007 was recommending to the legislature and to the governor of how we sort of move forward in payment reform. The first was tying payment to quality and efficiency of care. So part of that was for example, it's often called pay for performance. You're paying somebody for meeting outcomes on, like, optimal diabetes and vascular care, for example. So those were some examples. Level two would be paying for sort of care coordination, case management. And that was really getting at paying for providers for a lot of those activities that they do that aren't part of the face-to-face visit but sort of help facilitate care coordination. And then level three was establishing a system of total cost of care for providers as a payment incentive. So those recommendations to the governor actually and to the legislature resulted in, which I know many of you were around the table for, the 2008 state health reform package. A lot of that resulted in the longstanding programs that we have today, including healthcare home, the all-payer claims database, for example, standardized quality measures for clinics and hospitals. And the one that didn't make it was the total cost of care. I think the thought at that time is that some of the provider systems potentially weren't ready, that hadn't been maybe vetted or modeled or however you want to put at that time. So what was implemented at that time was the provider peer grouping, which I think now is and sunset it. And that was really to try and get at, let's start measuring cost and quality for providers and looking at that as a first step in doing that. So come 2010, I think folks were feeling a little bit more ready. That's when the IHP statute was enacted, and that's also when some of the Medicare programs were enacted at the federal level as well. And we'll maybe flip to the language, if you wouldn't mind, Heather. But the language, so this is the statutory authority. It's just the excerpt. I think it's the first subdivision, if memory serves correctly. But I think the purpose here was really about testing models, not to be prescriptive of the types of strategies that providers have to use, but more trying to define what the outcome was that we are looking for. And really looking at lots of different methods for paying providers. We're really trying to test these things, essentially, to see if they work. So back in the early days of IHP, we actually started almost right away in 2010, but into 2011, the first thing that we did was gather community input. There was a lot of questions that we needed to ask the community and have discussions with them about how this should look, how this should be defined, because, again, the legislation was broad and sort of gave us a lot of opportunity to test a lot of different models. So we received 40 different responses at that time. We kept them on our website for a very long time, and we're not now, but if anybody's interested in seeing those original, we're happy to provide those. But it was providers, health plans, counties, community providers, all sort of responded to give input into what the design should look like. And then we put out the initial RFP, actually right before the government shut down in 2011. So we literally put the button to post it on, and then the government shut down the next day. But one thing, sort of another piece of sort of the ongoing community feedback that's been the theme of this program was when we initially put out the design and the RFP, we had providers taking downside risk up front. And there was a bit of a reaction of that in the community of, oh, you know, I don't think we can do that. We have to figure out a way to sort of phase that down. So the department actually took the RFP off the street, revised the model, and made it so the risk phased in over a three-year period of time. There was originally 9 responders to that. So during 2011 and 2012, we worked with the providers. We were, I will admit, sort of building the plane while we were trying to fly it at the same time. And the providers were providing us a lot of feedback and input on how we could make improvements to the model and what it should look like while we were doing that contracting process. So originally 9, the proposed 6 ultimately ended up contracting with the department. So those are our original 6. And serving 100,000 enrollees, launching in 2013. So during that that same year of the launch of IHP in 2013, there was a legislative expansion that was provided to the IHP authority, and it really took that explore the expansion to you shall expand. And I think part of that at the time, although others that were here, please weigh in, and part of that was just the kind of unexpected initial participation and how many, you know, enrollees it was covering. And it also language that sort of clarified the intent around testing these different models sort of in and out of, or I should say alongside or in and out of the managed care environment. So the major IHP milestones to date, again, we had our initial community feedback, sort of the design. One major piece was in 2014, and it actually started before that, was the State Innovation Model Grant that we received from the CMS Innovation Center. That was $45 million that we received to really have that be capacity building grants and technical assistance and support for not just IHPs, but all of the sort of partner providers that we wanted to connect in with providers. So really to encourage that provider collaboration across the continuum of services, and many of the grants that we provided through that federal grant that we subgranted were actually placed on priority settings that we wanted to partner with IHPs. So we didn't just give all the money to the IHPs. We focused on behavioral health providers, long-term care providers, and also public health. And granted many of those to those different organizations to allow them to build capacity to work with the IHPs. We also did a second RFI in 2016. This, again, has been a theme of This process and this program has been iterative, and it has been built with community input. So at different phases in the program, we've sought public input and sort of discussion on what those next phases should be. That resulted in the IHP 2.0 changes that were adopted by the legislature last year. Thank you for that. And also the provided input to the next generation IHP framework that we put a request for comment out just this past November that we are going to get to later in the presentation. So this this is really just to give a snapshot of what the IHP program looks like today and some of the results that we've seen thus far since it began in 2013. So IHP was really designed, again, with the community to be flexible and to be adaptable, with the goal of improving enrollee outcomes and slowing the growth and reducing costs that we experience in the Medicaid program. That providers have an incentive to collaborate across settings and different specialties, and that those savings that they can achieve can be reinvested into those strategies. And that we're building off the local innovations that are already occurring. A lot of these providers already had things underway, and this sort of provided the financial incentive to build on that more or think of new strategies as well. This is the current list, and actually we're going to show you a map. It's not the best map, but we are working on our mapping skills in the next slide, so if you want to take a look at it while I'm talking, you can certainly do that. But really this is just to highlight that there are IHPs across all regions of the state. And the one thing that this list and the next map doesn't tell you is really about the diverse set of provider groups and organizations that are participating in the program. So a lot of these are collaborations. They're not just a single entity. So, for example, the FQHC Urban Health Network is 10 different independent FQHCs that have come together under a nonprofit to participate. Children's, that is not just Children's, what you think of Children's proper. They have a lot of partner providers that they have as part of their network for IHP. Same with North Memorial. Northwest Metro Alliance is a collaboration between Health Partners and Allina. Wilderness Health, which is in northern Minnesota, is a collaboration with St. Luke's and many other critical access hospitals and other providers up there. Heather's going to correct me if I get any of them wrong, and I'm sorry if I forget anybody. Integrity also as well in the north. And Southern Prairie Community Care, which is in southwest Minnesota, is a collaboration between those counties there and the providers in that area. So that's the map. The colors don't mean anything. They're just meant to represent sort of the different IHPs. So this also shows that really the enrollees and, again, the sort of spread or split between the metro and the non-metro area is pretty even in the IHP program. We have about half and half, and it also shows the number of individual providers is really high that's participating in the program as well. So one of the biggest strengths, I think, of and one of the biggest successes of the program has really been the growth in the provider participation over time, especially since this is a voluntary program. This isn't a mandate to providers. They get to choose to participate or not. So we have 21, and actually I think the number is higher now. Heather, correct me. This is for 2017. So 2017, we had 21 different provider organizations or collaborations participating and 460,000 enrollees. But with the ones that we have participating in 18, we have how many now, Heather? We now have 24. So that 21 number went up to 24 in the enrolling number. Okay, so that one's still close to about the same number. And really this kind of represents two things. One is there are new providers that are coming into the program, but there's also existing providers that have chosen to expand their provider network. So I'll just give North Memorial as an example. Their patient population was much smaller when they first started, and then they expanded throughout the process.
Ms. Zimmerman, yes, we have a couple of members that have questions for you at this point, so we're going to just pause and let them ask questions.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to go to Representative Lunan first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for coming here today. It's on this slide, so I'm reading this right, in 2013, that the bar graph indicates how many people that we're helping. That's what you mean by enrollees?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative. It represents the number of Medicaid enrollees, Medicaid and Minnesota Care, that are attributed to each one of these IHPs. And we say, when we say attributed, we mean their patient population, but it's not their entire population, and we're going to get to this in a little bit of a later slide, but it's sort of who is seeing those providers the most, and that's how we attribute people to those providers.
Representative Lunin.
So when I look at this, in 2013, we had basically 100,000 people were providing service to, and then just 4 years later, that number quadrupled.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Due to?
So, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Representative, one of them was, if I didn't say this, I apologize, but it's new providers participating. So you see that the IHP number 6 at the bottom under 2013, and if you see IHP all the way up to 27, so we have a lot of new providers that came in. We also had existing providers, which is why I use North Memorial as the example. They were one of the original 6, expand the number of providers in their network. So when you expand providers, you're expanding the number of people that are captured in the patient population.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. So this enrollment, these are people sliding over from the fee-for-service encounters. These aren't new people to the process then. So there should be a reduction in the fee-for-service population. That be correct?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, actually the IHP program, and now I'm sort of wishing I would have put some of the basics before I had put this slide, actually runs across fee-for-service and managed care. So it's a provider's patient population that's in fee-for-service and also in, you know, Blue Plus, Medica, you know, UCare, all of those different plans. So we treat it as sort of a single patient population for the purposes of this program. It's not moving people out of fee-for-service or managed care. They're staying where they're at today.
I think I should wait.
We'll move on. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that explanation. Even if we were part of writing the law sometimes, seeing it play out, it's helpful to hear it clarified. Really interested in the savings that you're showing there and how that plays out. A couple things come to mind. One, we want to save, right? We want to reduce spending in the system, and would be very interested to hear, and I think you're probably going to touch on this as we move on, where the savings are coming from and why this is working. But also, can you tell me a little bit about how the providers are reacting to the savings? Anytime we're reducing spending, we're also reducing somebody's revenue. And so are there other incentives that are put in place to help offset the way that we're reducing somebody's revenue in the system?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. And I don't know if it would make sense to skip to that slide or to wait, because I think some of these questions will get answered as we present the financial model. So if folks are okay waiting, that's essentially the foundation or the premise of the financial incentive that IHP provides, is that the providers are sharing in the savings that they are producing. So, for example, if you have a hospital-based system, right, so you expect them to reduce, and a couple of those slides are coming, their admissions, well, that's also revenue, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's them getting credit for that in the payment that comes back, so that's shared both between the state and the provider organization as well. But we'll get to that in a little bit more detail if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
We'll come back to you on that. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if Ms. Zimmerman, if I understand you correctly, on your chart on enrollees, it really is the entire patient base of a provider. It's not necessarily those who are enrolled in a specific IHP or getting any different care or delivery of services. So this would be, so if your example of North Memorial, if they were really managing under the IHP and assigned or recruited 10% of their patient volume into the IHP, it would only be 10% of what you're showing on the bar graph. Is that correct?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, partially. What really drives IHP attribution is looking at to exactly what you said, where people have already gone, so who they are seeing the most. And that's how we tell IHPs who they're accountable for and who is attributed to them. It's not a direct enrollment process, for example, like managed care is. It's not, hey, I've, you know, selected this on a form. It really is, this is my provider, I've chosen to go there, and we're looking at past encounters to see how frequently you've gone to that provider, and then you get attached to that provider for the purposes of this financial incentive. That's really what that represents. So it doesn't represent, to your point, their entire Medicaid patient population. Often the people that are seeing them the most or getting attributed to them are like 40 to 50% of any claim that they have from any Medicaid patient that's touching them.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we weigh the pros and cons of alternative approaches, I think that's it's really important to realize that it's only a small portion of the patient base that's getting any different sort of management or care coordination or even focus on their outcomes. And if the majority of the people on Medicaid are not, even though they see these providers, are being left by the wayside in terms of other potential approaches, we need to worry about that, because so many of the people on Medicaid are on short term. They're on between jobs when they can't afford or aren't offered COBRA and need something to cover their high prescription costs. They're families who have their hours cut or get laid off for one of their two jobs, and yet this may be the only time that they have comprehensive health care. And so I've always worried that we pay so much attention to the high cost flyers where the savings are impressive, and not enough to the basic health needs of the people that we're paying for every single month, making sure the kids are getting their well-child checkups, that they're getting their vaccines, that mom's getting a mammogram and dad's getting a PSA test, and, you know, making sure that the basics are taken care of. And so I hope that as we go forward, you'll talk about different segments of the population so we really understand who you're talking about with these models. That would be great.
Ms. Zimmerman, I have a question. DHS credits IHPs with saving an inordinate amount of money. I think it's like 200 and some million dollars in Medicaid and Minnesota care costs from 2013 to 2016. So has this amount and the methodology that has been used for determining that amount of savings been evaluated by an independent actuary or outside third-party entity?
Mr. Chair, I'll have Ms. Peterman answer part of that question, but we do contract with an actuarial firm, and it's actually a separate actuarial firm than we use for our managed care rates, to produce the targets. And this might make, again, a little bit more sense when we walk through the financial model, but the IHP program as part of our SIM grant was part of an evaluation from the U of M, so maybe Ms. Peterman can highlight that.
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair. As part of the SIM grant opportunity, we also engaged the University of Minnesota SHADAC to help with an evaluation of the IHP program. And so they separately reviewed information from the All Payer Claims database as well as quality information and found results that are consistent with what we have been finding and that you'll see in later slides as well. Around the impact that IHPs are having on reducing high-cost setting utilization as well as maintaining quality.
Thank you. If you could continue.
Mr. Chair, I would also add to that CMS, as part of that SIM grant, had their own separate evaluator, RTI, I think it's called, right, that had to evaluate our SIM program as well, IHPs being sort of the center feature of that. Maybe one more thing to highlight about this slide is that, you're sort of seeing it go up and a little bit down. I mean, part of that is because there's a couple of things going on there, one of which is we haven't completed the calculation yet for 2017. The other thing to note is these providers are in a three-year cycle. So when they start, so for example, the original six that participated in 2013, they get a target every year, but the contract is on a three-year cycle, and that sort of builds over a three-year period of time. And then in 2016, those six providers were rebased, essentially. They had a new base year in which their performance was calculated against. So depending on the provider, what their size is, when they came into the program, where they're at in their three-year cycle, will all sort of affect sort of the ebb and flow of that results over a period of time. That makes sense. We've touched on these a little bit, but there are some more qualitative, but also we'll jump back to some quantitative successes that Ms. Peterman will highlight. But really some of the more qualitative successes that we've had is, again, that the model was built with community input and collaboration, and that sort of continues even today, that we've seen a lot of success. We've seen providers that didn't know, in fact, the data that we're providing, and we'll get to that as well, just didn't know about some of the other services and other types of care that their patients were receiving, and really see that as an opportunity to partner with other providers in doing that. We see our IHPs perform very high on quality measures, and Heather can certainly highlight that as well. And, you know, maybe one of the biggest successes has been the flexibility. We have not tried to make this a one-size-fits-all model. We've really tried to make it so it can be adapted for many different types of provider organizations to participate, that providers can work on their specific data, their specific patient population to meet their specific needs, and that the model should and will continue to change over time as different provider needs and patient population needs change. Heather, you want to?
Also, through that SIM grant opportunity, DHS was able to engage 3M for some additional analytic consultation. They did a programmatic analysis that helped supplement the regular review that DHS does on IHP performance. Overall, they compared the enrollees that are served by an IHP to those that are served by providers that are not participating in IHP, and found that IHP enrollees were requiring fewer outpatient and inpatient facility stays while receiving a steady increase in professional office visit services, signaling that enrollees were getting care in less costly and less acute settings. We are showing the inpatient graph here on this slide. You see that the rate of admissions for members, for all providers, are declining during this four-year period, but the rate of decrease at 55 admissions per 1,000 was larger for IHPs compared to the decrease for members that were seen by non-IHP providers. Also looking specifically at events that could be classified as potentially preventable, these are things that, for example, are improved by care management or care coordination and follow-up. Again, the findings can be extended in that providers overall are seeing a decrease in this period, but the incentive and support that providers who are participating in the IHP program have allows them to outperform providers that are not participating. Here you're seeing enrollees that are served by an IHP had 9.5 fewer potentially preventable events per 1,000 compared to those that are seen by a non-IHP provider.
So now we're going to walk a little bit into the model basics. So what the structure is.
Ms. Zimmerman, we have a question for you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt. I'm just we're looking at these graphs and trying to figure out what the units are on them. Up the left axis there, are we talking about percent change, or is that a raw number? There's no unit on the graph.
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the rates are reflecting the rate of decrease. So on the one that was the inpatient admissions, that's the number of the rate of decrease, so it's admissions per 1,000. So, for example, the 55 is approximately where the IHPs are at versus 40 for the non-IHPs. That's the rate of decrease in admissions per 1,000.
So,
Representative Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair, so is that a percent, 40% decrease?
Ms. Peterman.
Chair and Representative, you can think of it as a percent, but it's the rate of decrease. So it's declining faster for IHPs than it is for non-IHPs.
What was the, follow up, Representative Liebling?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm still not clear. What is the unit of the number? Minus 40 what? Is it minus 40% of, you know, I mean, I understand that's the rate of decrease, but what is the unit you're using here?
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's the number of admissions declining. So
it's a raw number. It's a number. Okay. And then secondly, Mr. Chair, if
Representative Liebling.
And then what's the N in this? How many people are we talking about here?
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the analysis is based on the Medicaid and Minnesota Care members who could be eligible for the IHP program, and it separates them into those that are attributed versus not attributed. So for each of the year that's being compared, it's going to be the number of enrollees in Minnesota Care or medical assistance that could be attributed in the program.
So,
Representative Liebling.
So, in other words, the N varies across?
That's correct.
Yes, Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That I guess it requires some real thinking to understand what this is really showing us then. Thank you.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some of this, I guess this is some of the same questions, and I didn't get it figured out. So, if I'm redundant, I apologize ahead of time. So, on the reduced inpatient admissions, the count to the right is a not a percent count. It's not a of a 1,000 count. It's a true 60 people, 50 people, 40 people. Would that be correct?
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not a number of people. It's a rate of decline based on the number of admissions. So the number of admissions, in order to make it comparable across a population, we express it as per 1,000. So for any given member, any 1,000 members, how many times did they have an admission to the hospital?
Representative Lunan.
So just to make sure I have this right, so the 54 for the IHP, that really would be 5.4% then if it's per 1,000.
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's reflecting the rate of decline.
Representative,
is this going to be on the test? Maybe I don't need to know.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Zimmerman.
Clearly, we threw tables up here and thought, you know, we will provide a follow-up written explanation that we hope will be more clear to the members.
Members would, I think, appreciate that. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that would be helpful, but I think you're learning we're not statisticians. And it shouldn't be expected to be. But it would really be helpful to have targeted information on patient outcomes from people whose care was actually changed because of the model, not someone who just randomly happened to go to a clinic that happened to be connected to a network that happened to volunteer to be an IHP for some of its patients. We really need to know what the patient impact is on the people who they've selected to serve with different services. And that's a much lower level of data than most of this is being presented with. But that's what will make a difference in terms of us seeing this will be good for patients or it won't be. And what types of patients? Some IHPs, you said, specialized in behavior health. Some did the emergency room frequent flyers, chronic alcoholics, drug-dependent people who get beat up on the streets. We need to know which populations are actually seeing something different because of this. So if you can give us not just the big data picture, but also much more about the populations and the specific outcomes whose care changed, that would be helpful.
Ms. Zimmerman, I think I'm going to add on to what Representative Loeffler just said. And as I look at this chart, I did take statistics in college, so I'm a little bit of a numbers wonk. The one question that I would ask you to come back with us is to verify that we don't have duplicate enrollments. So what number of unduplicated enrollments are in these numbers so that we can verify that we have a data set for each one that doesn't have any overlap so that we have a true understanding in terms of the real rate of decline that you're portraying here? Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, we would be happy to do that. And we do agree. I think we were just trying to get at with this slide that we have seen a decline in inpatient admissions for these providers compared to others, but the point is very well taken that we need to make that information more understandable, but also we are going to get to some of the examples of what some of the providers are doing on the ground. But frankly, some of the providers are sort of best positioned even to discuss that in more detail themselves. We also have a book, and I can't remember if we provided it to the committee members or not, that came out of our SIM grant, but it's a really nice sort of compilation of all of the different activities that a lot of these different providers, both the IHP themselves and the partners to the IHPs, have been working on over the last couple of years that kind of get to that point. So we'll provide that to the committee as well. We didn't do that one. Sorry. I was forgetting where I was, Mr. Chair. I apologize. So this is really kind of getting at the sort of goals and purpose and the incentives that we are trying to drive with the IHP program. Again, you know, the point here is trying to do something different, trying to test different models and having that be flexible for the providers. That they have aligned incentives to achieve better outcomes for the enrollees, but also have something that is helping to reduce costs and making the program more sustainable. So what DHS provides is we provide data, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. We provide support to the providers, both in understanding the data, but lots of other technical assistance as well, and we provide the financial incentive. Providers build on the strategies and innovations that they have developed and that they continue to develop to improve outcomes. They share in savings that they create with their partners, and many of them are sharing that back with their partners. It's a return on their investment. So a lot of this is the providers are having to invest up front to do some of this work, and they are not the timing of sort of the shared savings payment is not coming until the year after the performance. So the providers are really putting in some of their own investments into this program. And also putting in new investments when they do get shared savings, not to just backfill and have that be a return on their investment, but they're allowed to invest, they are able to invest additional money as well for developing new strategies for enrollees. That we really want this to be more sustainable. We want this to be enrollee-focused. And providers are really using more less costly alternatives, which I think was brought up earlier, and really have flexible resources that they can use for their individual patient populations. I think part of the point that Representative Loeffler was making, which I think is a good one, is that some of these patient populations, the reason why these providers are focusing on different things is because their patient populations look different. Some of them have, you know, a patient population that has a higher rate of, you know, mental health. Other ones, the big issue is, you know, frequent flyers into the ER plus multiple other things. So it's really sort of allowing the financial incentive in the program to be flexible for them to address the unique needs of their patient population and their community as well. So moving into the basics of the model, we've been talking a bit about attribution and the financial component, and so we're going to try to walk through this and not be overly wonky in doing so. So I hope we achieve that at least to some extent. So in talking about so first, the issue was raised earlier about, are these people in fee-for-service? Are they in managed care? They're in both. They're sitting where they're sitting today, and this is really allowing the IHP to focus on their entire Medicaid and Minnesota care patient population, or for those that are attributed to them as part of this process. So the financial arrangement runs across the entire patient population. So it runs across fee-for-service and the different health plans that those people are landing in as well. So attribution just means how we attach these patients to the providers for the purposes of accountability and for the purposes of the financial arrangement. So we look back at claims data, we see where people went, and the IHP essentially that they went to the most, in the most simple way, is who they end up getting attributed to and who they are accountable for. That attribution method does prioritize healthcare homes first. That kind of trumps everything. If somebody's going to a healthcare home, that's their healthcare home, and they get attached to that IHP, but also primary care. So it's healthcare home, primary care, and then specialty care sort of comes second in terms of how we look at and how we attach people to these providers. It does not include dual eligibles, which I think has been a struggle. I think a lot of providers have been interested in that. But part of that is the construct of the financial model, that it is total cost of care. And for dual eligibles, people who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, Medicaid does not control, obviously, the dollars that come in on the Medicare side. So that's essentially the primary reason why dual eligibles are not included. I'll maybe pause there to see if there are any questions about that, since attribution came up quite a bit.
I see no. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lowe.
Well, thank you, Ms. Zimmerman. As I understand it, I get the attribution for data collection, but in terms of payment and enrollee choice on where, I mean, I think most of our enrollees with serious health problems actually would never put their specialist number three. They would put them number one and front and center if they're fighting, you know, cancer, whether they're fighting a chronic disease, whether they have mental health, behavioral health issues that are serious. They do not want to be attributed to a primary care doctor that they saw once because they tripped on the ice and needed to see if they had a sprained ankle or a broken ankle. And so, you know, I think we need to once again think about, you know, where is that greatest utilization rather than what is the first point that they saw somebody in the primary care. That's different than a coordinated care model where you ask people to create a medical home. But I think this is a point of distinction that for a lot of our patients who enroll in Medicaid because they need it with serious health problems would actually argue with, that they would really rather have the person who's saving their life be the primary person that gets credit for whatever good things happen in their life.
Response, Ms. Zimmerman?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, and I'm going to ask Ms. Peterman to help me. Oh, Loeffler, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Ms. Peterman. Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I apologize. And forgive me if I'm sort of misunderstanding part of what you're saying or part of what you're asking. So specialist is part of the attribution, and we're not actually asking people to make a choice. People, their choice exists as it does today, either in fee-for-service or in the network of providers that are available in managed care. So we don't in any way limit their choice here. We're looking back to see where they went for the purposes of calculating and using that in the financial arrangement. So we're not telling individuals they can or can't go to a particular provider or a specialist and that can't be their primary provider. In fact, part of the attribution, original sort of methodology around the attribution process, many of the providers provided us input that some specialties should be deemed as primary care, and so that's how we look at it for the purposes of attribution as well. So I just want to be clear that most of this is for the purpose of calculating the financial arrangement. It is not in any way intended to, nor does it limit people's current choice that they have either in their health plan or in fee-for-service.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm ahead of your presentation, but I did read your draft that you put out for public input just before the Christmas holidays, and always a great time to ask for people to take time for something new. And at that time, it said that one of the parts of the proposal that you're going to be bringing forward is that people would be assigned to a network based on the primary care setting that they had last gotten care in. And that is my concern about them actually being assigned to a network, not based on who they most rely on for care, but based on whatever primary care setting they had shown up for. And so that is the attribution, as you use that word, it's a unique word that we don't hear very often, is the attribution, as you're using it now, also related to your assigning? Because we know 85% of people don't pick a plan at their first enrollment because they're overwhelmed with all the choices and bad health usually at the same time. And so is attribution the same as enrolling in that IHP, ultimately, practically?
Ms. Zimmerman.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I understand now, and we will get to that later in the presentation. So that was part of a proposed framework that you're right. Yep, we did put it out a couple weeks before Thanksgiving, and we will get to the summary that we provided on that and sort of what we see as next steps. So that's not part of the current program. This is what I'm describing is the model as it exists today and sort of the basics. That was a proposed framework that has not been implemented yet, nor is it necessarily where we're saying we're going now. So we will get to that later in the presentation if that's okay.
Ms. Zimmerman, I have a question. So if someone attributed to a particular IHP, but its coverage for services elsewhere, who would be assigned those costs?
So, Mr. Chair, if the person is attributed to an IHP, and actually it's a little bit further down in this slide.
You can answer the question now.
They are getting care elsewhere if they're attributed to the IHP. That happens all the time. The IHP is accountable from a financial perspective for all of those services that person is receiving. So it's part of the calculation of the target, and maybe it'll make a little bit more sense as I walk through sort of the next components of this slide.
So then it goes back to the slide that we had so much question about in terms of the attribution of kind of the duplication of the overlap between the two data sets. So are you suggesting that both the assigned IHP and the service provider they do go to are going to be assigned those costs? Or even though they don't go to the IHP, the IHP is going to be assigned those costs. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, somebody's only going to be assigned once to an IHP. If that was your question, I apologize. You cannot be assigned to more than one IHP. You can be assigned to an IHP. That IHP is going to be accountable for you. You may receive services elsewhere that another provider is getting paid, let's say on a fee-for-service basis, but that provider over here is not accountable for your total cost of care. You are attributed to the IHP. You can only be attributed once. You cannot be attributed to more than one provider.
So then my follow-up is, how are you going to track those costs if they're not attributable to the IHP?
Mr. Chair, we use both fee-for-service and managed care and counterclaims to sort of develop the overall financial target. And maybe it's something that, if it's helpful, that was part of the presentation that I'm going to walk through in very short order.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So I think we've covered attribution a bit. So on the requirements, there's a ton of system requirements. There's a requirement that providers provide the full scope of primary care. I think part of that comes out of the or is closely aligned to statutory requirements. Providers can also propose the level of risk that they take. And, again, it's phased in over a three-year period for many providers. So that's it's upside only in the first year, and then you start phasing it in the second year, and then we kind of move to downside risk in the second year. So providers can propose the level of risk that they are comfortable taking, and that's part of the process. And they also have the flexibility to establish their governance in their contract. We don't necessarily put any limitations on that. So now getting into the calculation of the total cost of care target. This is how it's calculated and how, and then the next slide will sort of get into how we sort of calculate that and the performance. So the easiest way to think about it, I hope, is that it's calculated actually very similarly to a capitation payment that we pay a health plan, for example. So we're looking at that attributed patient population. So let's say it's 10,000 people. And we are projecting a per member per month amount of what their medical costs are going to be. And we use the same trends that we use in our managed care rate setting, so we are keeping aligned there. So whatever that total cost is, and let me provide a caveat to the total cost, because it's not every single cost in the Medicaid program. It does have some things that are optional versus mandatory. But that's how the target is calculated. It's essentially a per member per month financial target for their patient population for all of the costs that they experience in the Medicaid program. Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you. Can you give us a little more information about the base? I mean, we understand trend, which is your fancy word for inflation, medical inflation, but on what basis are you setting the capitation rate for different IHPs? used to say you did it based on fee-for-service, but we haven't had most of our population in fee-for-service for 30 years or something like that. What's the basis, and will it vary significantly by, from one IHP to another based on what kind of level of history? And do you count all cases, including people who are only on 6 months versus people who are on long-term?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I'm trying to unpack your questions here now. Now I wish I had written them down because I'm focused on the last one.
What is the basis?
Thank you. So it is the actual claims paid. It's the claims that are both paid by fee-for-service and all of the managed care plans for that individual for whatever the base year is. So let's say it's when the program first started in 2013. The base year that we're calculating is all of the claims that were paid, all the services for that enrollee in 2012. And then 2013 becomes the first IHP performance year. And so we're looking at that projection of what we think 2013 is going to look like versus how the IHP actually performed. I'm already getting ahead of myself in the next slide. I feel like I should maybe just go to it. And that's how it's calculated. So it is using claims data of what was actually paid for and experienced by the enrollee.
And then is it, excuse me, Mr.
Representative Liebling. Loeffler.
I
don't want to mix you two up.
Is it for people who are new enrollees, so there's no history in the claims database, then is an average applied?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, in order for somebody to be attributed to an IHP, they had to have been enrolled for 6 months continuously or 9 months non-continuously even to make it into the attribution pool. And when we look at where they were, the patients that were in their patient population in 2012, they are measured against their actual patient population that they experienced throughout that year. I'm looking to Ms. Peterman to make sure I have that right.
Ms. Peterman?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and perhaps I could add, Representative, that we are also comparing the IHP provider's performance to their own performance. So one thing that's slightly different is it's not just all of the performance providers together, but we look at the population and those services that Ms. Zimmerman described in the prior year for that provider system. Then we look at the actual services for the patients that that provider is seeing in the next year, adjust it for risk and the trend, and that helps us know the difference. So they are able to compare to their own historical performance, each provider.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, maybe one other thing to mention in terms of we keep referring to total cost, and I want to ensure that we're being clear that when we say total cost, we are talking about certainly quite a bit of services that are covered, but it's not all the services. Because really this started as sort of a primary care-based model. And so in that, what we looked at to determine what should be in the core sort of services that providers are accountable for, we were thinking about what does a primary care provider have the ability to influence. So those are things like inpatient and outpatient services, prescription drugs, mostly outpatient mental health and substance use disorder treatment. It makes optional, which some providers have taken up, to include services such as dental, non-emergency medical transportation, targeted case management, and some of the more intensive residential treatment for behavioral health. And some of those providers have chosen to include those in their total cost of care calculation. IHP 2.0, for the providers who are now participating in that, not everybody is, expanded that definition a bit as well. So I just want to be clear about the services that are included in that calculation is not the entirety of the Medicaid benefit. It is also not maybe some other big ones to mention that are optional are any of the long-term services and supports. So that would include PCA, any of the home and community-based waiver services, for example. The other thing that the providers get as part of this, which we'll talk about shortly here, is data feeds. We give them, they have a portal that they can log into, and we also give them monthly data feeds in order to see how they're performing against their total cost, to identify trends, to drill all the way down into specific patient populations, and we'll touch on that a bit. So I don't know if we want to I'll say maybe just a few more things about this chart, and then we'll move on. So as Ms. Peterman mentioned, the total cost of care is IHPs being measured against themselves. They're not being measured against other providers and their own patient population, how they improve from 1 year to the next. The sort of line in the middle, the dark dotted line, is what the target is. Red and green are kind of if you come in above or below that target, whether or not there's a shared savings or a shared loss. Those little dotted lines on both sides of target is a 2% threshold that providers have to exceed on both sides. And really part of that is ensuring that we know that whatever the reduction is, that it had to do with that provider's activity. As this committee well knows, there's variation in healthcare expenditures, so this is the way for us to say we know this had something to do with you. But to be clear, and this was actually a piece of feedback from the providers, the savings go back to the first dollar. So they don't just earn savings above the 2% threshold. It goes all the way back to the first dollar. Our managed care organizations that we contract with participate in the Integrated Health Partnership program with us through their contract. They pay their sort of share of the savings and then would receive their share of the losses when that would occur. So, for example, if an IHP, and I'm going to pick on North Memorial again just because I saw Buck earlier, let's say that their shared savings amount was $1 million. That $1 million is essentially allocated between DHS for fee-for-service enrollees and then the different health plans that their attributed population is in. And all of the payers essentially are sort of paying their share of the shared savings payment. DHS also provides data to the health plans of the enrollees that are in IHPs on their costs, how it is relative to their target, and the attribution on a regular basis, so the health plans have visibility into what's going on with the IHPs as well. Providers still maintain their own separate contracts with the health plans. The IHP financial arrangement is completely transparent, so the IHP can use that, and it is to the health plans as well, can use that in their discussions with their own negotiations. And there have been times in the past where we have provided technical assistance to health plans and to the IHPs as well to ensure there wasn't any duplication of counting of savings and that type of thing if the IHP also had a contractual arrangement to do a similar type of total cost of care arrangement with that provider. Some of the MCOs have also partnered with some of the IHPs as well. So, for example, Blue Plus provided a lot of startup funding to Southern Prairie. Health Partners, in its collaboration with the Northwest Metro Alliance, since that's both Health Partners and Allina Clinics, and Hennepin Health and HCMC. So we've seen a lot more collaborations, and some of those folks actually came together on some of our SIM grants as well and proposed to do sort of pilots and look at specific subpopulations as part of that.
Ms. Zimmerman? So on the a couple questions. I want to back up to the slide where you're describing the model. And so in the determination of the virtual shared savings. So how many are in that virtual?
Mr. Chair, that might have to be one that we follow up with you on. I'm not sure we know that one off the top of our head.
So looking for the number, how many, the amount that providers have seen as part of that shared savings? And then with the integrated, I'd like to know the amount that providers have seen as part of the shared savings, but also if any providers have seen loss sharing, the flip side to that. So if you could get back to the committee with that as well. So the question that I have with your current slide is, So in your presentation on the slide of the MCO interaction, how do you know that IHPs are reinvesting their shared savings back into the system?
Mr. Chair, part of that is the IHPs reporting to us what they spent their money on. There is no formal reporting process other than what we had through the SIM grant. So really it's just our regular interaction with the providers and them essentially telling us what they're doing with their funding, unless Ms. Peterman wants to correct me.
Ms. Peterman, there is an old phrase that we've bantied about, trust but verify. So how are you, you're obviously trusting, but where's the verification for this committee to rely upon the information that you're providing to the committee?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. One of the other ways that we monitor or watch the development of how the providers are using the information in addition to the feedback that they give us is when they submit their applications to participate in the program, we ask them to detail out the interventions that they are exploring, and we look at how those are developing. Of course, a key component to the model is the outcomes, so that's the other indicator that we have of how the providers are using the information is ensuring that we continue to see positive outcomes for enrollee experience and the other quality metrics that is part of their requirements under the contract.
Ms. Zimmerman.
So, Mr. Chair, I think part of that is also just in working with the providers over the years, sort of the initial investment and the ongoing investment as well, and us not wanting to provide an additional amount of burden. It is one of the things that we actually proposed in the framework that we released in November of 2017 of having more aligned financial reporting between the IHPs, similarly that we have with our managed care organizations today.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. And I appreciate you being here today, and obviously by the questions we have lots of curiosity about this idea. And I'm looking at the slide that's titled the MCO interaction and thinking through what you've been testifying about so far about the payment. And in the fourth bullet, you talk about the IHP financial arrangement and the contract is transparent. And I'm wondering if you could just elaborate on that a little bit. And then when you think about fee for service payment, but also managed care, inhabiting enrollees that would be participating in this. I'm just wondering about that transparency and how it extends and how those two things relate to one another. And I know that's a big question. But
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, so when we say the IHP financial arrangement is transparent, the contract is posted on our website. Everybody has access to it. We have provided numerous reports and evaluations that we've made publicly available. We sit down with the providers and we walk through multiple different exhibits with them of how this impacts their patient population, how the attribution looks, how total cost of care is calculated, and we do that with the health plans as well. So we provide really a lot of assistance and sort of insight into how it's calculated. We don't just say, well, here's what it is, and trust us. We really walk through all of the different calculations with them.
Representative Murphy.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, then, one of the issues I think that we have wrestled with in this committee, at least in my tenure in the House, is the fact that the information, once DHS engages in a negotiation with the health plans around payment to providers and in payment for care delivered, that information is not related back to us, so we don't see it. As a legislature, it's hard for us to judge. And I'm wondering that as we think about IHPs, if that same prohibition will exist in terms of our ability to also take a look or understand beyond the contract that's posted, the way that the interaction between the Department of Human Services and the providers is happening. So it gives us a little bit more information to evaluate in addition to sort of the rolled up aggregate. And understanding, as I ask that, I want to make sure that we're, you know, keeping patient data private, et cetera, et cetera. But right now, we don't have a great deal of information to evaluate on payment, and I'm curious about your perspective on this looking forward.
Ms. Zimmerman.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, and you're going to have to tell me if I don't answer all of your questions.
Yep.
I think part of the challenge is we see through claims, so for example, in managed care, what the health plans are paying the providers. DHS, as the state, is not a party to the contracts between the providers and the health plans. So there's that. So we're not a party to those contracts. We don't see those contracts. If we requested them, we could certainly do that. That's not part of the standard practice. I think one thing that we do need to get better at, and we have tried to, I think, is producing more of that data that we're getting from claims. So right now, statute has that classified as non-public data. For example, the paid data that we're getting from the claims from the managed care plans. But I think there's a lot more that the department can certainly do to produce that in a way that is aggregate. And I don't mean aggregate that it's, a big number across the entire program. But as long as we are producing information where we're not getting down to a small number of claims where, you know, something could be deduced from it. I mean, essentially that's what we try and do. We try to do that when we produce a data book for the health plans to compete in terms of our competitive procurement. That's what we do with the IHPs as well. So the IHPs are seeing some of these individual claims. Just to be very clear, the department takes out the paid amount on some of those. And when we show them data in the dashboard that we'll get to here shortly, we do, you know, blind anything that has lower than a certain number of claims to get at that. And I think there's more that we can do to show that publicly and not just make that available to the IHPs. And I'm not quite sure if that's the point that you were getting at, but that's certainly something we can do a better job at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Zimmerman. I like most things with regard to this model and the way that it's going to work. I think I would love to follow up a little bit more and talk about the transparency and where it begins and ends, but we don't have to do it right now in the committee. Yep.
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair, so we started talking about the data, and I just wanted to expound a little bit that it really is one of the key contributors to IHP's ability to make positive changes. The fact that it's comprehensive is of primary value. By that comprehensiveness, I mean that, as Ms. Zimmerman mentioned, it includes both the information about the services and providers and conditions that might be apparent on claims for fee-for-service, as well as the various managed care organizations that the enrollees might be in that are being seen by a provider. So it's comprehensive in that nature, but it's also comprehensive in the sense that it includes information not just, again, about what's happening at a particular IHP provider, but also the other services at other providers, which helps those IHP providers better coordinate care. You're seeing on the slide here an example of the provider portal that we make available to IHPs. We actually offer the information sets to providers in a variety of formats, including automated secure detailed files, so that providers can access and use the information that makes most sense for their organizations. They have a variety of capacities when it comes to or platforms in terms of how they might be able to use or integrate the information. So that flexibility is important here as well. The portal allows them, through a web-based ability, to kind of run on-demand reports or see at a glance how they're performing in both summary type as well as more detailed reports on care management and other utilization topics. One example of a care management report where providers can see the distribution of chronic conditions for the enrollees that they're serving compares how the distribution of chronic conditions for their members might compare for other similar medical assistance enrollees. But they can click on the specific condition, as an example here, and get the list of members where there's evidence either through the claim treatment or on the diagnostic information for those that are impacted by that condition. We understand that providers then can use this to supplement their registries and use them for things like targeted interventions.
Ms. Peterman, we have a question. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Peters, this is all chronic conditions. None of them are preventative care. Are there other slides that you just this just brought as an example? And who set the or how do you set the benchmark? And is the benchmark spending, is the benchmark achievement of a certain blood level management target? What's the, for example, on diabetes, you know, what's the benchmark? Is it money or is it an actual health outcome?
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, it really varies depending on the type of report that the provider might access. In this particular report, yes, it is just looking at chronic conditions, but that's because of, again, feedback that providers are asking us to help develop the report that can help with their care management efforts. So to the extent that they might have a particular care management effort around diabetes or around heart disease or something like that that speaks to these chronic conditions, we would try to develop a report that gets at that. There are other reports, like, for example, some that speak to the various quality measures. So those would be using benchmarks that are consistent with how the providers are reporting those measures through Minnesota Community Measurement. Again, back to this report, the benchmark here is just giving them an idea of how many of the members that they're serving have these conditions compared to how we see across medical assistants and among other providers the distribution of those chronic conditions. So this one was intended to help them target those chronic condition programs. There are many other reports, as you saw on the portal dashboard, that speak to lots of other topics. This just happened to be a care management example.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a follow-up, if you can get us information on outcome measures that you're using right now and the basis for that, because incidence doesn't really tell you anything except who chose to visit your clinic. And you may have had more that choose to visit your clinic than the guy next down the block. But that really doesn't tell you anything about patient quality or, you know, outcomes. And it's really about network performance rather than provider performance, it seems like. At this point, it's not an individual doctor being able to see how his or her patients are doing.
Before we leave the data topic, I just wanted to provide one more example of how we use, again, provider feedback to help us continually improve available tools to support their efforts. While providers have expressed generally a high level of satisfaction about the claims-based reporting that we can provide, they have suggested to us that even more valuable would be near real-time notifications from their electronic health records. And so, again, with the support you provided last year, we were able to get federal match dollars to begin implementing an encounter alerting service that facilitates sending admission, discharge, or transfer information to authorized members of a care team. Ms. Zimmerman had mentioned before the interaction between the information that's made available and the flexibility of the incentive payment and how those all work together to support IHP actions and strategies that lead to results. Some specific examples of interventions that we know IHPs are exploring include several IHPs that are using things like community paramedics to do follow-up after a discharge, helping support medication reconciliation for people with mental illness. Others are using local community providers to help connect people, for example, those with diabetes, to support educating and finding and cooking healthy foods. So these are just examples of strategies that providers are using. Again, the key point is that through their shared savings, they have the flexibility to really target these based on where the needs are. Well, the model has certainly seen success both
Ms.
in
Peterman,
terms of...
Ms. Peterman, we have a question. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And This is not a question, but just a comment as I look at this, and especially when we're thinking about people with chronic conditions and in communities and people with known chronic conditions. I appreciate the point about using community paramedics, and I think, you know, they play a valuable role. But I also hope that we're exploring these community health workers and that we would continue to look to ways to elevate them because they're probably more culturally prepared, both culturally and from a healthcare perspective, prepared in this environment to intervene and help us in that trajectory of keeping people healthy and home.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Zimmerman.
And Representative Murphy, I just wanted to follow up and say we actually do have quite a few examples, and that is a strategy being utilized by quite a few IHPs. So with the follow-up information that we provide to the committee, we'll sort of have that packet of here's all the strategies that the providers are employing.
And Ms. Zimmerman, just going back to the question that I asked you previously, I do think that it's important that we get at the root in terms of how the IHPs are reinvesting those shared savings. So I don't want to, you know, let that be forgotten, that that is something that I think the committee would very much appreciate, and it's important to our valuation of the overall IHP model. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Peterson.
We've spent some time talking about the successes, but I did want to just highlight some of the lessons that we've been learning. As Ms. Zimmerman mentioned, providers are on a three-year contract cycle, so it provides sort of a natural opportunity for us to really continually look at what's working well and what could be continued to be improved in the model. And one of the things that we are continuing to look at is the long-term sustainability and effectiveness of the incentive structure. Certainly, since the current model bases the IHP's performance relative to their own past, it may be difficult as we get into future contract cycles for efficient providers to keep up that level of savings. And so looking at ways that we can smooth out at least a portion of that savings being available to support their activities is an important feature. We also continue to look at ways to include and engage a broad range of providers and provider types in the model. Some of the challenges include that, you know, the measurement methods are limited when we have very small providers or providers that are treating, you know, specialists, for example, that have very small number of people that don't allow us to do the risk-bearing type arrangement. And so we want to continue to figure out ways to include them in the model. Related to the range of providers, one of the other things that we continue to review are how to incorporate relationships with non-medical providers. We've encouraged that, but we wanted to strengthen the incentives because we've understood that those take time to develop, that they are not always well-defined and need ongoing support to help that. Another area of concern, we've talked about it a little bit, relates to the retrospective nature and the primary care-centric nature of how accountability is assigned, so that attribution question. We've looked at ways to continue to stabilize that patient-provider accountability relationship. And that also means exploring ways to encourage enrollees in being engaged in their own accountability for their outcomes. A fourth area of lessons learned and kind of things to continue to improve on is around drawing a clear distinction between the roles and responsibilities that providers and our managed care organizations may play when it comes to care management, and then how to accurately evaluate how the actions by the different parties are contributing to the savings and the outcomes. And lastly, again, as we've touched on just a bit, the different criteria and requirements across various programs that an individual may go between, for example, aging into Medicare or transitioning between fee-for-service and health plan, introduce some inconsistencies that we would like to see have a better smoother and, again, more consistently positive experience for enrollees. So those are some examples of things that, you know, through the current model, we've learned lessons that we'd like to see improved.
We have a question from a member, Ms. Peterpin. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, I don't know whoever applied, Ms. Zimmerman or whoever. So the IEP, my understanding is the IHPs depend a certain amount on federal grant program for funding. And, you know, with the changes at Congress, is there any indication that there might be changes with the federal funding, or we haven't heard much?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, possibly what folks are referring to is the SIM grant that we were referring to. So that is closing this year. That was $45 million, and that was over a temporary period of time. And a lot of that was to do a lot of the capacity building to both the IHPs, but their partner providers as well. We have not seen any change in direction sort of at the federal level on payment and delivery reform. I would say the one change, and this was, part of a, I want to say it was the CHIP reauthorization, but I could be making that up, the MACRA and MIPS that are part of Medicare, that got delayed for a couple of years. But really that isn't about the direction of payment reform. Most of that is about sort of the meaningful use requirements that are part of that and sort of trying to relieve some of the provider burden. So I would say any sort of change and shift between the previous administration and this current one has more been about reducing provider burden, but they continue to remain committed to the payment reforms and the ACO programs that they have for the Medicare program and in Medicaid as well, and they continue to approve them in other states.
Follow-up, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So the $45 million, that was a one-time payment?
Ms. Zimmerman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, yes, it was.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Just one other question on your presentation. I appreciate it, the information you've given. But let's say I'm an IHP here, and I'm getting, you know, it's towards the end of the year, I'm getting closer to that line where I'm going to have losses rather than a benefit. Isn't that kind of like an incentive to ration care, or maybe human nature is different in healthcare versus other places? But I'm just saying, if I'm a IHP and I see my cost getting close to that line where I will have, well, I'll be penalized rather than rewarded in terms of the overall cost of care, unless I'm reading something wrong, there would be an incentive to defer or ration care to stay under that line so I'd get the benefit of sharing in the savings. Or am I perceiving that incorrectly?
Ms. Peterman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the model intentionally makes sure that we're balancing that incentive. So it's not simply how they're performing on cost, but a portion of that shared savings is also contingent on how they perform on outcomes measures. So, we continue to watch those utilization metrics, those quality metrics, and they would not be eligible for the full component of their shared savings if they do not achieve those quality outcomes components as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to be really brief in just highlighting a few ways that we've tried to address some of those lessons learned that I mentioned. We did have an update to the model in 2018 where we clarified the participation tracks and added, most importantly, a population-based payment to try and help smooth out some of that available dollars. It's sort of like a pre-savings payment you could think of to support those care coordination efforts. We also made intentional steps in building the 2.0 model to ensure that we added health equity and population-based measures so that even those providers that are participating in a no-risk arrangement have the same quality incentives, and added additional ability for providers to receive more shared savings when they have more formalized partnerships with their community partners that were helping them achieve those outcomes. So it was just a start at addressing some of those lessons learned, but there are still more that we wanted to try to get additional feedback into, which is what brought us to the request for comment that was issued earlier at the end of 2017.
And I think Ms. Peterman and Ms. Zimmerman, what I'm going to have you do is, because that kind of segues towards the next gen, I'm going to ask that we conclude your presentation for today here, and then we can start fresh with next gen tomorrow. And so, members, if there aren't any further questions with the 10 minutes remaining, I just encourage you to keep these packets in your save file, and we'll just conclude with questions with the time remaining. Representative.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this last point in terms of rewarding people financially for community partnerships and working, my concern, and I brought it up when the CSRS proposal and the $45 million was brought forward, is that we really were being presented with a model that was based on rural health care and having really one major service system in your area. My block, they're probably of 30 houses, there probably isn't three of us in the same health plan, and I can tell you my community agencies don't really want to work with 12 different entities, all of whom want to claim that they're a partner, but it's really hard to coordinate for nonprofits, let alone our cities and other things, and I would like to hear more about how you think this can actually really work in a community in which people are flipping health plans left, right, and sideways because their employer keeps changing them every 2 years trying to save a nickel. And even if you stay in the same health plan, your ability to keep the same provider changes year to year because of contract negotiations that are in a very competitive market just don't work. So, you know, we have a lot of community resources, but they serve a lot of people, and they're like everybody's nonprofits and agencies. They can't work with 12 different partners, all of whom have a different flavor of, quote, coordination. So if you could give us some information on that, that'd be great.
I think that's a follow-on request by Representative Loeffler. And so with that, members, our next meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, March 14th. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.